From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, futurists Alvin and Heidi Toffler. The two say they felt snubbed by American academics as crystal ball gazers. But now, thanks to Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich, a Toffler devotee, they're becoming GOP gurus. We'll talk with them about their ideas. Also, the contradictory life of writer Anaïs Nin. We talk with her biographer, Deirdre Baer. Baer has also written biographies of Samuel Beckett and Simone de Beauvoir. And linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us what he's been reading to his 5-year-old daughter, Sophie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Traffic is beginning to move again on California's Monterey Peninsula, which has been deluged by California's heavy rain. Officials say one lane of Highway 68 in each direction has been reopened. The road is one of two routes into the region that can be safely traveled. Highway 68 was closed until late last night when receding water let the Highway Patrol lead convoys in and out. Each convoy was no bigger than 20 vehicles. The National Weather Service is calling for yet more rain in central and northern California. The south will have dry weather. At least 12 people have died in the storms. 39 California counties are disaster areas. Senate Democratic leaders say they'll work to block a Republican move to let contractors hire permanent replacement workers for employees who go on strike. UPI's Pi Chamberlain report.
Under a new presidential order, companies that replace striking workers permanently will no longer get to do business with the federal government. Senate Republicans proposed a plan to kill that order. Now Democrats are filibustering the Republican move. Democratic leader Daschle says he expects to hold on to the 41 votes needed to keep frustrating the Republican move.
I think so. We had 42 votes last week, and I don't know of any votes that have changed, so I expect that the vote will be the same. It'll be a close vote.
Daschle says if Democrats can keep holding firm, there is an understanding the Republicans will give up and let the president's order stand. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
President Clinton addressed a Washington meeting of the National League of Cities today. He defended his administration's record and said he's been working on welfare reform for years. Mr. Clinton says the Republicans' plan to deny welfare benefits to teenaged girls who have children out of wedlock doesn't work.
I think that's a mistake. I think what we ought to be saying to people is, you should not have done that. You made a mistake. We don't want anybody else to do it, but we're going to help you succeed as a student and a parent and a worker, and you have to help yourself by playing by these rules. I think that is a better approach.
House Speaker Newt Gingrich also spoke to league members this morning. He accused President Clinton of failing to lead. He also responded to questions about a controversial college course that he's taught in Georgia. The course has been at the center of an ethics complaint lodged with the House Ethics Committee. Critics say Gingrich's course has been financed by his Political Action Committee. Senate Republicans are considering ways to save half $1 trillion over 5 years. New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg heads a GOP task force that's reviewing social benefit programs. A draft report calls for moving more welfare responsibility to the states and cutting back on Medicare, federal retirement programs, farm subsidies, and other programs. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 14 points at 4,021. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Cuban President Fidel Castro is in Paris today for meetings with President François Mitterrand and other French officials. It's the first time the Cuban leader has been a guest of one of the major Western powers. Joe Schumann reports from Paris.
A military band and honor guard greeted Castro at the French Élysée Palace for his first visit with the leader of a major Western country. Though Castro arrived in France in his signature green military fatigues, he met with President Mitterrand wearing a dark suit and tie. Mitterrand, who has increased French trade with Cuba and called the American embargo of the island nation stupid, welcomed the Cuban leader with a handshake in front of a swarm of photographers. Castro will also meet with French parliamentary and industrial leaders, but his historical visit has not been trouble-free. Some 50 Cuban protesters demonstrated against Castro's human rights record, and the French foreign minister said Cuba should do more to advance democracy. But Mitterrand, to justify the visit, has said if France kept diplomatic ties only with countries who respected human rights, that wouldn't be very many. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Schumann in Paris.
Former Mexican President Carlos Salinas reportedly has fled his country in shame. A Mexico City newspaper says Salinas and his family went to New York or Miami over the weekend. The paper cited sources close to the Salinas family, saying the former president may settle in Boston. It's not clear why he left Mexico, but speculation had grown since Salinas' brother was accused last month of planning the murder of one of Salinas' top allies. Many Mexicans also blame the former president for the sorry state of the Mexican economy. An Israeli army official says PLO chief Yasser Arafat could be the intended target of a roadside bomb that was found today in Gaza. The explosive was taken apart just before Arafat was supposed to drive through the area on his way to his office in Gaza City. Israeli Army Radio reports the bomb, which was made of more than 100 pounds of dynamite, was hidden in a plastic barrel that was used as a road divider. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Newt Gingrich's thinking about America's future has been influenced by the work of futurists Alvin and Heidi Toffler. In fact, Gingrich wrote the introduction to their new book, Creating a New Civilization, The Politics of the Third Wave, and he's recommended that members of Congress read it. This book continues the themes that the Tofflers first stated in their books, Future Shock and the Third Wave. According to the Tofflers, the human race has undergone two great waves of change. The first was the agricultural revolution that made farming possible. The second was the industrial revolution. Now we're making the transition into the third wave, the information age. And this third wave is changing everything from politics to the family. But the Tofflers think politicians on the whole have been slow in catching on. They say both parties are obsolete, stuck in industrial-era thinking. I asked what advice they've given Newt Gingrich on how to bring Congress into the third wave.
Well, you have to understand that Heidi and I met Newt long before he was in Congress. He was a young teaching assistant when we first met him back in the early 70s. So we've been friends with Newt Gingrich independently of politics for a long, long time. And we have a very exciting intellectual relationship when we meet with him. We argue, we fight, we fuss. And so we don't have a formal relationship either with Newt or with the Republican Party or anywhere. We're not Republicans. We're not Democrats. We are intellectuals. We write. And we have ideas. He finds many of those ideas useful and I think understands many of them more deeply than most politicians do. By the same token, we find some of his ideas repulsive. Tell him what he originally said years ago.
He's always been aware of disagreements, and when we first met him, he said, you're going to agree with maybe 80% of what I say and violently disagree with 20%.
So Newt Gingrich says you disagree with about 20% of what he puts forward. So what are some of the issues in that 20%?
The separation of church and state, the issue of choice.
Abortion and choice. And there are plenty of things that we would argue about.
And something that that Newt and certain this is the conservative coalition faction of the Republican Party.
Christian
coalition. The whole emphasis on family values. My question always is whose family's values? One family may have a very different set of values than another one.
We would argue and do argue in all of our work that what's happening with the rise of a third wave is what we call the demassification of society, including family structure. And what that means is the industrial age was based on mass production, mass distribution, mass consumption, mass education, mass recreation, mass media, and sometimes weapons of mass destruction. The sociologists taught us that industrialism gave rise to mass societies which were essentially homogeneous. They emphasized uniformity and homogeneity.
And it was
standardized family form. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Heidi's right. That what you had was the assumption that everybody has to grow up into a nuclear family with a father who goes to work, a mother who stays home, and 1.8 kids or whatever, and that this was eternal, universal, and the standard form. What's happened as in fact we foreshadowed in Future Shock in 25, 30 years ago. We had a chapter in that called The Fractured Family, in which we said that we're moving into a period of high diversity and we're going to see many different family structures, not just a single model for the whole society. And that, I think, is exactly what has happened. And I believe that the family values folks who reflect honest and genuine feelings and ought to be respected for their views, despite the fanaticism of a few of them, nevertheless have a unitary, a kind of homogeneous view of what family life ought to be. We differ with that.
Well, in Future Shock, you predicted that the family may fall apart, but it would come together in new ways. You predicted there would be more childless marriages, more older people raising children, gays adopting babies, polygamy, temporary marriages, marriages that assumed that as each member of the couple changed, the relationship would be likely to change as well and might in fact end.
Has it happened?
Well, wait, yeah, well, don't you think it has?
I think it's happened right on target.
Absolutely, but we said serial polygamy, which is not having several wives at the same time, but having very
sequential marriages.
Which has happened also.
To have said that does not necessarily mean that we endorse it, that it's a wonderful thing. It's a painful, traumatic change when a family, when a society's family structure undergoes change. It's painful, it's bitter, it's agonizing.
How would you say your view of the family compares to Newt Gingrich's?
Well, I think Newt probably has a less relaxed view of the changes that are taking place, so to speak. I think he would agree with returning function. Let me give you an example. By the way, I don't think that we should be measured by the Newtometer. We have written these books for millions of people around the world who've read them, and Newt Gingrich, who is a pal, finds the ideas stimulating and valuable. That's fine. But I don't think that everything we do has to be measured by a Gingrich metric. I think that I'll give you an example. The movement of work back into the home, which we have encouraged and written about for many, many years. We're with people who are finding ways of using their PCs or their faxes and sometimes without technology to work at home. We think that's a pretty good thing. At least not for everybody, but for a lot of people. If you look at the society, what stands in the way of doing that? Well, you got giant corporations who want to keep their workers under total supervision every moment. They don't like it. But also the IRS doesn't like it. And the trade unions hate it. Newt Gingrich wants it. He favors the return of work or making it easier for people to work at home. That's a third wave policy in our judgment.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Alvin and Heidi Toffler. They've written a new book called Creating a New Civilization, The Politics of the Third Wave. And I should mention, if Heidi's speaking a little bit less, it's because she has laryngitis. You know what I'd like to do? I'd like you to apply your thinking about the information age to one of the big debates now in the political system, which is about welfare. And I've chosen welfare not only because it's one of the big controversies of the moment, but also it says something about employment and unemployment.
Sure.
And the way money should be used. And these are all issues that you cover in one way or another in spelling out your philosophy. So do you see the welfare system as being a remnant of the industrial era?
I think the way the welfare system is organized is indeed a product of the second wave industrial era. The industrial society presumes that work is essentially interchangeable. It's based on muscle power.
But it's not that way anymore.
No, that's the big change. You have to understand
that.
Well,
those jobs are going out of the country. They're going to developing countries.
So what does that say about how unemployment today is different from unemployment in the industrial era?
Bravo. Yes. Okay, here is how. In a second wave society, if you have unemployment, we learned more or less what to do about it. From the experience of the Great Depression, the economists like Keynes and monetarist economists taught us that if you have a million workers unemployed, you could stimulate the economy by manipulating interest rates or by putting purchasing power back into the hands of the public and so forth and so on. You could stimulate the economy and create a million jobs. Then the million unemployed take the million jobs, and presto, they have resolved the unemployment problem. That's a mechanistic industrial era approach to unemployment. It is second wave thinking, properly applied to second wave employment.
You didn't have to educate people any differently.
Now, you've got 1 million people unemployed. Let's say you do that. Let's say you lower the interest rates, and let's say it even works to stimulate the economy, and you do all those, you go through all those games, you stimulate the economy, and you actually create 5 million new jobs. But these 1 million people can't do those 5 million jobs.
Because they're not trained for
those jobs. Because work is not any longer as interchangeable.
Let me get this back to welfare. What you're saying is that the whole job situation has changed. You need more specialized, high-tech type of skills than you needed in the days of factories.
No, not necessarily high-tech, but you
need
skills.
Specialized.
You
okay.
also need a lot of service workers.
Okay.
And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to be a service worker.
Good. Let's take this back to welfare and apply what you're saying to how you think welfare should be reformed or eliminated or whatever you think.
I confess, I don't have a, Heidi and I don't have a magic plan to solve this problem. However, the existing assumptions under which the welfare system was laid in place originally is that people are more or less alike. And we think that the fervor, the anger at the welfare system, which is by no means limited to whites or angry white males, that's baloney. I've talked with plenty of blacks who despise the welfare system far more militantly than many liberal whites, that the welfare system clearly has not created, as we have moved into the third wave, we created more and more unemployment among those without skills. The welfare system hasn't addressed that problem at all. The welfare system, in fact, has simply
said... And it's failed in every respect,
except perpetuating itself. Yeah. So it's time to shake it up and rethink it.
Well, let me ask you a fundamental question. What responsibility, if any, do you think the government should have...
Which government?
The government of the United States? Oh, you mean federal or state?
Exactly. Exactly. One of the great arguments, one of the great things about America has been that it's been less centralized than France, less centralized than Japan, less centralized than most other industrial countries.
But more bureaucratic.
So you think it's a smart idea to have the states assume some of the responsibility?
Indeed. And the phrase used to be that the states are potentially the laboratory of democracy, that they could do different things and see what works. The other thing is that we believe, and there are many people who surely differ with us, but we believe the United States is the parts of the United States, the regions of the United States, are growing less alike. They're becoming heterogeneous rather than homogeneous. And the consequence of that is what works in one place won't necessarily work in another. And our welfare policy, as well as our, I must say, our Federal Reserve policies, a lot of our policies, assume that you can turn a magic switch in Washington and you'll provide medicine for everybody. That's not the way it's working now.
Okay, so because we're becoming more heterogeneous, that the state should have responsibility, you think, for creating welfare programs. Should any part of government have responsibility for helping out people who are perhaps trapped between that second and third wave, people who aren't prepared for the jobs that exist now?
I think that, yes, government does have some responsibility to help. After all, a lot of these people are not in a bad situation because of their own doing. The society is changing. The structure of society is changing. And therefore, we need to be aware of that. And, you know, Heidi and I have been writing about this stuff for 30 years, but nobody and urging people to think about these problems so that they would not hit as they have, in fact, hit. Nobody paid much attention to that. And nobody took advance action to prevent it. So here we are. And I think, yes, government has some responsibility for people who are not capable of doing things on their own. There are millions of handicapped people in the society. There are millions of people who, for one reason or another, are not capable of having jobs, even if the jobs are available. And there is a certain residual amount of responsibility that government has. But that does not necessarily have to be Uncle Sam. What Uncle Sam, it seems to me, has to do is to assure that at the lower levels of government in the states and in the cities, that the return of power to them does not allow them to become local tyrannies. that simply shifting power downward, which is what Newt and the Republicans are eager to do, needs to be accompanied by something that the Democrats ought to be doing. The Democrats ought to be saying, yes, we agree with you. We want to shift the power downward, although the Democrats have a hard time saying that because of their constituencies. We want to shift that power downward, but we also want to guarantee that when it gets down there, states' rights does not become a euphemism for racism as it was before. I frankly don't think it will, because you now have blacks voting, you now have black officials, you now have minorities participating in ways that were not the case 50 years ago. But nevertheless, I would like to see devolution downward plus additional strengthened federal insistence that we observe our Constitution.
My guests are futurists Alvin and Heidi Toffler. They've written a new book called Creating a New Civilization, The Politics of the Third Wave. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Alvin and Heidi Toffler are my guests. They have a new book called Creating a New Civilization, The Politics of the Third Wave. In part because Newt Gingrich has read a lot of your work and advised others to do the same, I've asked you your thoughts about him. Let me ask you your thoughts about Al Gore, who's probably the Democrat who's had the most to say about the Internet and the information age. What's your assessment?
Well, before we do that... Yeah. Newt Gingrich also wrote the introduction to this book.
Good point. Yes, he did.
Yeah, yeah. I think Gore, and I think Heidi would agree with this, Gore is a highly intelligent guy. He has been aware of this. He was co-chair of the Congressional Clearinghouse on the Future, which is an institution which we helped set up in 1975 to get Congress and members of the Congress thinking more about the future. So he's thought about this a long time.
And his reinventing government.
However, and his reinventing government initiative is good. But if you look closely, the problem is not Al Gore. The problem are the constituencies that trap the Democratic Party and make it impossible for Gore to carry out what he wants to do. So that reinventing government is good, but it's just nibbling at the edges of the problem, because every time you try to change the institution, whether it's housing or health or any one of the government bureaucracies, you're up against the very voters who the Democrats require to get elected.
Now, you both not only have information age credentials, you have industrial credentials. You've both worked in factories. Heidi, you used to be with United Auto Workers. Do you think we're in a transition now? Factories are no longer, you know, as big a source of employment as they once were. Labor unions have changed, and a lot of people at work no longer have labor unions, and they no longer have the kind of benefits that the unions fought for and provided, health insurance, pensions. And so a lot of people would you say a lot of people are kind of trapped between the second and third wave
absolutely.
Right now, the industrial and the information
absolutely.
Era, and they don't have?
You're dead on. That's exactly the way to describe it. Yes, we have one system phasing out, another system phasing in, and by no means yet fully understood, and all the necessary changes and adaptations and institutions have not been invented. And people are caught in this process, which is what happens in history. I don't mean to be at all callous about it, but when the Industrial Revolution came, it was a massively painful process for societies, because the old ways of life fell apart. Everybody could look around and say, my God, it doesn't work anymore.
And most people couldn't imagine being anything but a farmer.
Yeah, and Heidi's absolutely right. Think about somebody sitting here 300 years ago and having a discussion about the economy of the future, and somebody saying, well, there's going to be some strange new economy out there that's different from the one we have. And the other person, reflecting the conventional wisdom of the age, says, what? A society? Can you have a society in which 90% of the people are not peasants? because that's the way life was for all those years. So it's hard to imagine.
As we continue the transition into, you know, the information age, some people are clearly winners. They have the good jobs. They're on the internet. Life is more exciting. They have opportunities. Some people are losers. They don't have the education. They don't have the skills. They don't have the jobs.
They don't have the motivation.
Some. Okay.
Some.
Is there a way that we as a culture, we as a society can help the people who are getting lost? Yeah. Or do you expect that we're going to become a more divided nation between the haves and have-nots as we get deeper into the information
age?
That
clearly is possible, but it's not inevitable. When Newt Gingrich said, we ought to provide a laptop for every kid in the underclass, everybody laughed at him. And of course, he said maybe that was a silly idea. But in fact, that is not stupid. Maybe not doing it that way. But if you want the children, the upcoming children of this generation, whether they're black or white or Latino or Asian or whatever, to be part of it, you've got to educate them in totally new ways. The public school system is a disaster. And what you therefore have to do is have an education which provides computer literacy, media literacy, as well as traditional literacy. And you've got to totally restructure and reorganize that. That's something that I think Gingrich understands. That is something that is very and the Democrats understand it, some of them, but it's very difficult for them to do it.
How has Newt Gingrich's public mentions of your work changed your lives?
Well, what it's done is it's brought an avalanche of media attention, much of it trivial, but not all. And it hasn't changed our lives in any substantive way. We are what we were before. We are writers. We think of ourselves as thinking individuals. We're trying to make sense of a very complex pattern of change and to help other people understand it. That's what we devote our lives to.
And we're getting a lot more feedback now.
Yeah, an enormous amount.
More people are paying attention to the ideas, I think, because of Newt Gingrich.
Is it ever hard for you to publicly disagree with him
because
he speaks so highly of you?
Why? We disagree with him publicly right here anytime on all kinds of issues, like, as Heidi pointed out at the very start of the show. We believe in choice. We believe in a sharp separation of church and state. We believe that prayer in the schools is not a wonderful idea, et cetera, et cetera. We say these things. We say them out loud. We say them repeatedly. And we also say something that's never reported or seldom reported, and that is that we also meet with Democrats in politics and tell them exactly the same things. But the focus is on Newt because he is such a charismatic figure and because he literally holds up our books and says,
more than that, he's a man who really has a vision. He's a visionary, and he wants to make true revolutionary change. And
that's the level of change that this country now requires. Not necessarily the specific changes that he wants, but an understanding that making a few incremental changes are not going to cut it over the next 10 or 20 years. We're going into a very turbulent period, not just domestically, but outside globally as well.
Elvin and Heidi Toffler. Their new book is called Creating a New Civilization, The Politics of the Third Wave. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the life of Anaïs Nin. We talk with biographer Deirdre Baer. She says that Nin, in her life and writing, explored three important 20th century subjects: sex, the self, and psychoanalysis. Nin was best known for her diaries, novels, and erotica. And linguist Jeff Nunberg ponders his five-year-old daughter's emerging sense of taste. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan is criticizing a key government gauge of inflation. Greenspan says the Consumer Price Index, or CPI, doesn't accurately reflect the cost of living. He says this triggers increases in entitlement programs like Social Security.
The fixed-weight nature of the CPI and other aspects of its construction point in the direction of an overstatement of increases in the cost of living. Even if this upward bias were only a fraction of a percentage point per year, the relentless compounding of such a discrepancy ultimately would have budgetary consequences meriting serious attention.
Greenspan estimates that if the government made the CPI more accurate, it could cut $150 billion from the federal deficit over 5 years. The Clinton administration isn't worried about British objections over its planned reception of the leader of the Irish Sinn Féin Party, which is allied with the Irish Republican Army. President Clinton has granted Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams a U.S. visa and plans to meet with him at the White House. Adams will also be allowed to fundraise for peaceful purposes. British Prime Minister John Major has criticized Adams' trip, but the White House points out that the Sinn Féin leader is allowed to fundraise in Great Britain with a few restrictions. Secretary of State Warren Christopher met with Syria's president for 5 hours today. Christopher says progress has been made to further peace talks between Syria and Israel. Christopher is stopping off in Jordan today for a brief visit with King Hussein before going on to Israel. The BBC's Lisa Doucette reports.
Amman has tended to be Mr. Christopher's most pleasant stop. Over the past 2 years of his shuttle diplomacy, problems on the Jordanian-Israeli tract never seemed as intractable as those he still deals with in Damascus and Gaza. But this time, Mr. Christopher will have to face growing disillusionment and some outright criticism of Jordan's peace treaty with Israel. King Hussein will want to be assured that Washington's pledge of financial aid to those courageous enough to make peace will be respected. A congressional subcommittee recently proposed a major cut in promised debt forgiveness. That for Jordan was even worse than the worst-case scenario. Jordanian officials had regarded debt forgiveness as the very least the United States should do to help ease their economic difficulties.
Lise Doucette reporting. Trader Nick Leeson is not talking about fraud charges that he faces in Singapore. The British currency trader appeared in a German court today and refused to respond to the charges. He's allegedly responsible for making bad guesses on Asian currency markets that led to the collapse of Barings Brothers Bank. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow fell more than 10 points to end at 4,025. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The Clinton administration's policy on gays in the military is facing a legal challenge today. Six members of the armed forces are suing in federal court. They argue the so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is unconstitutional. This permits gay men and lesbians to serve as long as they don't reveal their sexual orientation. The plaintiffs argue they can be fired for exercising their free speech. The Pentagon says gay men and lesbians are bad for morale. The plaintiffs argue that discrimination once practiced against black soldiers is now aimed at homosexuals. The Transportation Department reportedly is investigating whether Denver officials improperly diverted federal funds intended for the city's new airport to other civic services. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Federal law dictates that a city that accepts federal funds for an airport cannot use revenue generated by the airport for any purpose other than the facility's capital or operating cost. Today's Washington Post quotes Transportation Secretary Federico Pena, who was mayor of Denver during part of the time covered by the probe, as saying he was confident that all federal funds were properly used. Pena says he's aware of the investigation and is fully supportive of it. The probe includes a $240,000 lobbying contract in 1991 and 92 with a Washington law firm in which Ron Brown, now Commerce Secretary, was a partner. During that time period, Brown lobbied for Denver. Pena says the question is whether bills from Brown's law firm were allocated by the city's budget director to the proper accounts. He also says Denver's finance officer has assured him the funds were properly allocated. If the Transportation Department Inspector General concludes that the money was improperly diverted, Denver could lose part or all of the remaining funds pledged for the new Denver airport. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The devastating California floods will be felt around the nation in grocery stores. Growers in the Monterey Peninsula say they'll have huge losses. They estimate half the area's spring lettuce crop is gone. Strawberries are also underwater. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Anais Nin wrote diaries, novels, and erotica that changed the lives of many of her readers. This was particularly true in the late 60s and early 70s, when the women's movement and the counterculture coincided. The message many readers took away was that if women were brave enough, they could be both sexual and independent and devote their lives to art and love. Deirdre Baer was never affected that way by Nin's writing. What Baer wanted to know was who paid the price for the life of this self-involved woman. Deirdre Baer has written a new biography of Anais Nin. Baer is also the author of biographies of Simone de Beauvoir and Samuel Beckett. Baer doesn't think Nin was an original thinker in the way de Beauvoir was. According to Baer, Nin was a major minor writer. Nin died of cancer in 1977 at the age of 73. I asked Deirdre Baer if she now sees Nin as incredibly self-involved or as someone who made personal discoveries that inspired others to change the ways they lived.
She was both, really. She certainly was self-involved. She certainly was narcissistic. She was her own favorite subject. She wrote every day. There were 260,000 pages of diary writing plus innumerable folders of loose writings, and they were all about herself. She was her favorite subject. But in the process of writing about herself, she would write about herself, at the beginning of her 40 years of psychoanalysis. She would write about herself throughout her many love affairs with, among others, Henry Miller, probably the most famous. She would write about her troubles, her travails with various publishers who continuously rejected her work and even rejected the diary. So that all the while that she was writing about herself, this narcissistic self-involvement, at the same time, she was representing, to my mind, many of the major attributes of the 20th century.
Some people called her diaries her liaries because they felt there were so many lies in them. How close to the truth are her diaries? And I guess we have to distinguish here between the two sets, the published and the unpublished.
Not only the published and the unpublished, but the recently published so-called unexpurgated diaries, which are now appearing, Henry and June being the first volume in that series. When she decided to publish the diary and when she finally found a publisher for it, she realized that there was much material that she couldn't allow to be made public because so many people would be hurt, including each of her two husbands, for she was a bigamist, and members of her family, her mother, her brothers. If they knew about all of her sexual peccadilloes, they would be astonished as well as deeply hurt. And so she had to find a way to write about these things without actually writing about them in their entirety. So these were many aspects of the diary, many passages that either had to be deleted or had to be changed. Much of her activity she had to give to other persons. And in several key instances, for example, a cousin, Eduardo, who was very important to her throughout her life, he was very much afraid that she would insert his life into her published diary. And so she needed him. As she said, I need someone to be the person who introduces me to psychoanalysis. I'll simply change his sex and change his name. And so Eduardo became Marguerite, a mythical character who stayed in the diary. So these are the kinds of things that she did.
I think Nana's known for two different types of writing, best known for two different types of writing. And one is her diaries, and the other is her erotica.
Yes.
And, I mean, her erotica, I think, is among the most widely read erotica for at least a certain generation of women. And Nin was, in her own life, I think, very preoccupied with sex for many years. How did that become a preoccupation of hers?
I think it started with D.H. Lawrence. Up till that time, we had all of the Victorian obfuscation. We had never faced sex directly. Well, Nin read Lawrence's book, and she was recently married. She had been married for several years to a very fine man whom she adored and with whom she had a complex relationship. His name was Hugh Guiler. She called him Hugo. The problem was that neither one of them knew a thing about sex when they got married, and they had a relatively celibate marriage for the greater part of their first year of married life together. So that when Nin read Lawrence, to use a colloquial expression, it blew her mind. And then, almost immediately after, she met Henry Miller, who had been writing about sexuality with the same openness that Lawrence had written. And very quickly she fell into a sexual affair with Henry Miller. And from that point on, the act of sex became, for many years, the paramount facet of her existence. At one point, just to finish up on this, at one point one of her analysts said to her, "You simply have to find a way to relate to people which is not sexual." And she said, "I can't do it."
Why would she have so much trouble?
Because she felt that the only way that she could express even simple friendship was through giving her body in the act of sex. This really went back to her childhood. It's fairly well known through the published diaries that her father abandoned the family when she was 10 or 11 years old. And her mother took Anais and her two brothers to New York. And the father was an absent figure for 20 years. Anais didn't see him again until she was 33 and he was 55. And at that point, they began an incestuous relationship.
What did her friends think about her incestuous relationship with her father?
Well, you see, they never knew it. They never knew this until the unexpurgated Henry and June appeared, because all of those passages had been deleted from the first published diary. She had hinted about it to many of her close friends. They had told me the various ways in which she had hinted about it. But there really was no real proof until Henry and June was published, and also until I was able to read the unpublished diary entries and to talk to the surviving members of her family who were in Paris at the time this happened.
How did she feel about it herself?
The curious thing is, I've talked to a number of persons who do scholarship on incest victims and willing participants. And they tell me that when a parent and child are separated at a very young, when the child is very young, and when they come together as adults, that this is far more frequent than we know. There are many studies which have been done to prove that biological parent and child who come together as adults frequently do engage in incest. Her father was a man without boundaries. As one of his children said, "I would put nothing past my father. I would believe anything of him." And consequently, he and his daughter, Anais Nin, and her father, Joaquin Nin, engaged in an affair for a period of something between 4 to 6 months.
My guest is Deirdre Baer, and she's written a new biography of Anais Nin. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Deirdre Baer, she's written a new biography of Anaïs Nin. How did she start writing erotica or pornography, whatever word you want to use?
Well, that happened in 1940-41. They were in New York, war had broken out, and Henry Miller had extraordinary expenses, and she was paying for him for about 10 years. She kept Henry Miller. He was her kept man. She gave him an allowance every month that allowed him to devote himself to his writing. And the allowance, of course, came from her banker husband. And Henry couldn't write the pornography because he wanted to devote himself to his own writing. So she took over because she needed to pay his rent. And the collector, the so-called collector of it, didn't want her to put any poetry in it. He wanted nothing but sex. He wanted 100 pages a month, and he wanted them to be all entirely about sex. Well, everyone who has read this erotica, which consists now of two books, Little Birds and Delta of Venus, realizes that she wrote about sex and sexuality from a woman's perspective, and she wrote about it with deep feeling and a great deal of poetry, and it really is some of her finest writing. That's the irony of it.
Maybe you could say something about why they caught on so well with women readers.
Well, I think for the same reason that the diaries did. The first diary was published in 1966 when the feminist movement was really just beginning, when women were seeing, understanding the possibilities that were open to them in their lives, in their human relationships. And the erotica, which came out a decade later, in the late 70s, just after her death, actually. It was the same sort of thing. By this time, the feminist movement had really caught hold. And so women felt freer to discuss their sexuality and felt freer to explore various kinds of sexuality. And so here came these beautifully written books about the sexuality of a woman written by a woman, and certainly they captured the imagination not only of women but of men.
I think one of the reasons why Nin's writing appeals or has appealed so much to women is because some of it explores the role of woman. You quote her as having said earlier in her life, "I didn't want to rival men. I didn't want to steal a man's creation, steal his thunder. Creation and femininity seem incompatible." And she talked about how aggressive the act of creation was. A lot of women of her generation just assumed that a woman's role was to support a man and not to be an artist or any kind of professional in her own right. Do you interpret Nin's statement here as a sign of the times or as something more personal than that?
Well, she certainly did say everything that you said. The interesting thing was, all the while she was mouthing those statements, her behavior was quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
She was saying that she needed to be, or she wanted to be, she felt her role was to be the helpmate of the man. But at the same time, she was so jealous of Henry Miller and so eager to be accepted as a writer the way he was. When he began to be known, for example, she said, T.S. Eliot is writing him letters praising his work. Why isn't he doing it for me? That kind of thing. So that all the while that she was setting herself up to be the perfect helpmate, at the same time, her actions were constantly defying that role. She wanted to be the writer. She wanted the attention to be hers. She would say, for example, of Virginia Woolf and Rebecca West, writers like that, they write like men. They're so masculine. But she yearned to write the way they did and to have the reputation that they did.
At a certain time of her life, I think it was when she was around 42, she's much more upfront about that and says that she decided to become the writer herself.
Yes. This was after she broke with Henry. By that time, he had gone off to California, and she was living in Greenwich Village and had bought herself a printing press to publish the novels that no commercial publisher would take. She said, you know, if no one else wants it, I'll simply do it myself. So she really was a pioneer, very brave about that.
I don't walk away from your biography of Anais Nin liking her very much. She seems really narcissistic, hopelessly self-absorbed. But I'm fascinated by the contradictions that you write about, that her life represents.
Yeah, that for me, that was what kept me involved in this book for the 3 years or so that it took me to write it, because everything that she did, everything that she said was a contradiction, and yet at the same time, all of these contradictions really add up to the stuff of every woman's life. I really think that every woman in the world can read this woman's life and not only can learn something from it, but can also learn what not to be, what not to do.
Are there people who are angry with this book because she kind of burst the bubble in a way, because this inspirational, sensual, poetic figure is more damaged than Nin's own writings would lead you to believe?
Yeah, that always happens with biography, and I'm reminded of a column that I wrote for the New York Times, a Hers column about Simone de Beauvoir, and the headline writer, grasping for a headline at the last moment, actually gave me the phrase that means a great deal to me when I think about both Beauvoir's life and Anais Nin's life. The headline was, "Do as she wrote, not as she did."
Well, how does that apply to Nin?
Well, it applies to Nin because in her writing, you know, again, these diaries, so inspirational for women. You can be anything you want to be. You can do anything you want to do. You can shape your relationships to make you happy. You can relate to people in ways that create a better world, all of this sort of thing. That's what she wrote. What she did, in effect, was to wear herself out running between two men, making herself, what shall we say, a doormat, a housemaid, whatever, for any number of men, denying her own writing, denying her own creativity to satisfy the needs, what she perceived to be the needs of other people. So she certainly didn't live the life that she wrote about. And that's what I find is so infinitely sad about her.
Deirdre Baer, she's the author of Anais Nin, A Biography. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Isabel Alegria reports from California on the flooding there. Other stories, Elizabeth Arnold has a story of speeches to the National League of Cities today by President Clinton and House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Linda Wertheimer talks with David Wellna about the possible whereabouts of Mexico's former president, Carlos Salinas. John Nielsen begins a series on the woes of suburban America, and I will talk with the author of a new book about how the Irish saved the great books of Europe, making copies in monasteries in Ireland and in missionary monasteries abroad.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Linguist Jeff Nunberg has strong opinions about language and literature. Now he's observing his 5-year-old daughter begin to develop her sense of taste.
The philosophers of the Enlightenment used to hold that nature endows everyone with an innate little kernel of taste, which grows with cultivation. I have to say that up to a while ago, my 5-year-old showed no signs of any such organ. She eschewed Big Bird for a half-wit dinosaur who sings treacly songs about dental hygiene. And after that, well, what can I tell you about the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers? Think of the kids' adventure show that Ed Wood would have produced, except that this doesn't have the same high production values. And then all of a sudden, it started to emerge. In the car the other day, she asked me to put the Elvis tape on, and then when I did and it started to play It's Now or Never, she threw a fit and said she wanted to hear the one about the hound dog. And then there's this abrupt and unaccountable passion for the tales of Beatrix Potter. History hasn't been very generous to Potter, at least by comparison to her near-contemporary A.A. Milne. I expect one reason is that most people have trouble getting past the names of her characters, Benjamin Bunny and Tommy Tiptoes, and of course Peter Rabbit's siblings Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail. The irony is that there's nothing cloying about Potter's tales, none of the preciosity you find in Milne. I always have the feeling that the Pooh stories were written so that grown-ups would find them darling. Whereas Potter's an uncompromising realist, with a wryness that leaves her tales always coming out a little equivocal. Her stories are populated by real-life folk who fret about their livelihoods and get themselves caned and occasionally wind up as somebody else's dinner. There's no condescension in Potter's language, either. The other night, for example, we were reading The Tale of Johnny Town Mouse. This is really just Aesop's story of the country mouse and the city mouse, but Potter turns it into a contemporary tale. Johnny Town Mouse is an Edwardian dandy with a long tail and a white necktie who dines on the scraps of the elegant upstairs dishes and who talks a great deal like Max Beerbohm. When the country mouse says he has to return home, Johnny Town Mouse says, "I confess I am a little disappointed. We have endeavored to entertain you, Timothy William." I doubt whether even an Edwardian five-year-old would have made sense of that, and the Lord only knows what it meant to Sophie. She lay there with her eyes fixed in the middle distance, looking over every once in a while to check out the pictures and playing with a string of a Barney balloon she'd gotten at a birthday party earlier in the day. I read on. The city mouse visits the country mouse, who asks after his old friends. Potter writes, "Johnny's account was rather middling. He explained why he was paying his visit so early in the season. The family had gone to the seaside for Easter. The cook was doing spring cleaning on board wages with particular instructions to clear out the mice." Middling? Board wages? I looked over at Sophie, but she was still lying there, abstractedly twirling the string of her balloon. Maybe it doesn't matter, I thought. Maybe it's just like the structuralist used to say, literature is just the play of empty signifiers. I read on. "There were four kittens," Johnny said, "and the cat had killed the canary." Sophie sat up with a start. "What's a canary?" she asked. I guess that's what they mean by reading for the plot. And of course she's got it absolutely right. All very nice about the seaside and the cook, but when it comes to the crunch, it's the cat you want to keep your eye on. Just like everything else in childhood, listening in on all those incomprehensible conversations and trying to figure out what it really comes down to. It's supposed to get easier as time goes by. You get to be culturally literate, and you can pick up all the references and read the way a grown-up does. But then you realize that the only books that ever mattered to you are the ones that were too hard at the time. You think of the first time you read James or Joyce tearing through one paragraph after another in rapt incomprehension. It was never so agreeable again. Moby Dick would be no better if you took a course in whaling first. And who do you think gets more pleasure out of Johnny Town Mouse, Sophie or me?
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landrell. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.